Welcome to our whistleblower world at Whistleblower Network News. I am your host, Jane Turner, FBI whistleblower and constant whistleblower advocate. We look into the lives of whistleblowers or their advocates, brave souls who are prophets of conscience. President Biden has referred to whistleblowers in the highest of praise, referring to them as accountability actors. I just refer to whistleblowers as heroes.
In February of 2021, when she completed a Whistleblower of the Week interview, we had a wonderful story on her. I would ask people to look it up. It was really wonderful. And a lot has happened since then. People know Rebecca as an American geographer, a data scientist, an activist, and a whistleblower. That is important to know. She is a whistleblower. She managed the team that created the Florida Department of Health COVID-19 dashboard. She blew the whistle on the state misrepresentation of that data. And Rebecca, I am so excited to have you on today because a lot has happened. But before we get into you telling us the rest of the story, let me say that I heard some disturbing rumors. Somebody mentioned to me that they had heard that I no longer supported you. And that is not true. 100% not true. And I think that you'll find that people like the Enron whistleblower, Sharon Watkins, years after she blew the whistle, has had people coming after her, planting stories in the press, saying all these negative things. And the same thing is happening to you. That is what happens when you take on the government. So please, Rebecca, with my full support, backing, and love, tell me what has happened since our interview on February 1st, 2021 on Whistleblower of the Week. Tell me what's happened.
That's been more than 2 years. Gosh, that's a long time. Well, a couple of months after we did that interview, nearly a year after I was fired, the state of Florida's Inspector General's office granted me official whistleblower protection. They said that they had reasonable cause to suspect that the things that I alleged had happened, and a little too late, but I guess better than never, that legal whistleblower protection, which I still maintain to this day.
Yes.
During that time, our complaint was still with the state. Typically, these reports, you're supposed to get a response about your protection status within 90 days, and the full report is supposed to be done within 180. And we did not actually get a final report from the state until September of 2022, which was 2 years and, I think 3 months after we filed. So this was a highly unusual situation in which the state was, you know, breaking their own policies and statutes by dragging this on, essentially to determine in the end in a one-page letter that because I was fired before I filed the complaint, I could not have been fired for filing the complaint, but that my complaint showed that the state broke the law in doing what they told me to do, and it constituted a specific risk to public health, safety, and welfare. Because we could not file our lawsuit in civil court until we had exhausted all procedural remedies within the structure, you know, the way you're supposed to do things. Mm-hmm. We didn't get permission to even file our civil suit until last September. And we did that just a few weeks ago on the 3-year anniversary to the day that I launched the dashboard.
Yes. And December 7th of 2020 is when they raided your house.
Yes.
And you've also had Governor DeSantis personally weigh in on your case. Pretty unheard of. Yes, many times. He really has a fascination with you, doesn't he? He just can't help but stick his fingers.
Let's not talk about with his record and putting in fingers. Let's not talk about DeSantis's fingers. But it's a kind of sick obsession almost.
Yes. I mean,
I had been on calls, like group calls with him in the past. And the only time we had a direct conversation over the phone was about some of the new pages we were developing on the dashboard and general kind of, that looks good. That looks fine. What is this thing right here? Can we fix that? And that was it. That was literally it. There was like one thing I think that needed to be fixed, and it was a date formatting issue. That was the extent of our interaction. I built the dashboard and the public data systems by myself at the Department of Health. Some of my some of my employees were stuck in India at the time because they had gone over in like February and could not get back. So I was completely on my own for months. I did this 16, sometimes 18 hours a day, every single day, Monday through Sunday, because there was no one else who could do it. There was no one else who even had access to my account to do it. And that was my whole world. And I took it very seriously. And we very quickly became leaders in the country on how to do this right. I mean, Deborah Burks was on the morning news circuits bragging about how we had released data zip code by zip code, which was my doing and my doing only. I was the only person who knew how to code that. And the level of granularity, the transparency with how we were reporting. My data schema, I found out just a few weeks before I was fired, was used as the template for all states to try to model after. And that was pretty surprising for me because of how ad hoc the whole process seemed. Right. I was just kind of following my, you know, what I thought should be done. I led interagency calls on best practices with data reporting and transparency by the federal government. Even when my mom and dad lost their house in an EF4 tornado on Easter Day in April of 2020, even though it was only a few hours away because I was in Tallahassee, near Mississippi, I didn't go help initially because 20 million people would have been left in the dark as to what was going on in COVID. And it was mid-April. And it was when things were very scary and uncertain. And if all of our data systems just went down and then the public found out that it was because, oh, don't worry, you know, our data person had a family emergency in Mississippi. It's like, you only have one person. We knew that would happen. So we often would refer to the team and it was just me. And we didn't really need people to know that. I think at one point my boss said to me, is like, you need to drive very carefully when you're going home tired tonight, because if you die, our whole system crashes. Yes. So, which was good to know.
Yeah. So you were a valuable state employee. There was no doubt about that. Yes, you were valuable. And then you saw something very disturbing. You blew the whistle on it and all hell broke loose. I don't know how else to capsulize your story besides the fact that your whistleblower journey has been just awful. I mean, they've been throwing rocks at you for the last 3 years.
Yeah. And it's been very bad for the last two.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I never used Twitter really before any of this happened. I think I had like 30 followers and they were all my friends from college and I think my sisters. After everything happened, I let my sister kind of take over it for a little while just to tell people what was going on because I was hiding. And then I started using it and I built up a decent following, like 60,000, maybe 70,000 followers. Decent. But it was all Florida-centric. Outside of Florida, that was a story that kind of popped up in the beginning of COVID, and then just people didn't pay attention after that. But after the raid, unironically, my profile just exploded. You know, people like George Takei were telling people to follow me. I'm almost at like 400,000 followers now, which is super weird because everything that I say, no matter how hypo-ridden or spur of the moment or just completely useless and just talking about my life, gets like millions of people to see it. And that is a strange thing that I've never fully felt like I've earned, but it was because I shared the video of the raid on my home.
Yes.
And
terrible
police issued public statements to CNN in their official capacity saying that guns were never even drawn when they came into my house. And we counted at least six officers with weapons pulled on my family and on me. Yes. One person pointed a gun at my head and told me to open the door. They claimed they had a warrant. They did not. They brought the warrant 3 hours later as they were leaving. Nearly a dozen police officers came in my house at any given point. Of course, none of them wearing masks. You know, it was a very traumatizing ordeal. And it was something that people didn't expect to happen in this country to not only just scientists and government critics, but people who frankly look like me, like a pretty little white family. It was shocking, I think, for a lot of people in America to see that because they have ideas about what that looks like. And I didn't fit that.
No.
And so it was very jolting globally. It won me some pretty strange awards, even some that were created just for me. Forbes created an award called Tech Person of the Year for the first time and gave it to me and didn't even tell me. I found out like days later on Twitter. Of course, I fled to Maryland on January 4th of 2021, which was perfect timing. I lived like 4 miles from the White House, so things were just great as we were trying to just get groceries. And, you know, the few days after we lived there, I thought I had moved into a war zone.
Yes.
And then 6 months later, I got whistleblower protection. And that moment was actually caught on film while we were interviewing for my documentary. And I was at my mom's house. We were doing an interview about something else. And I got the email. And I think I just started crying.
Yes.
So that'll be great when that comes out, which should be in a couple months. You know, Hollywood, though, they drag their feet and it's something that is important. But
what's important is you got the label. You are a whistleblower. There's no two ways about it. I personally back you. I honor what you've done. I just am amazed with the strength you have shown over these years, because you've had some horrific things that have happened. They took you off of Twitter at one point.
Yes. Oh, yes, they did. So before I got whistleblower protection, I had actually been working with an amazing reporter named Sarah Blasky at the Miami Herald for months. I turned over literally every document that I had kept. Like, I exported my inbox from my work account regularly because there were a lot of red flags and I thought maybe I'm going to need a record of this. And I sent her all of that, all unedited. I'm talking about thousands and thousands of lines of data and documentation. And her and I were going through it together. And so the story had been planned for a while. It was actually supposed to come out before I got recognition, but because we had to legally provide, you know, certain people an opportunity to respond, it didn't. And so when it finally did come out, waiting and waiting and waiting for a story that proved that everything that I said happened, happened, not only happened, but that Department of Health and employees testified under oath that it happened, was huge. And by this point, after the raid, I had a dedicated troll army. Nobody really bothered me except for a few creeps up until that point. But it was clear that what had happened, and especially DeSantis's public attacks on me afterwards, were bad enough that they could sour his chances as a presidential hopeful. So I got a full-time coordinated attack campaign dedicated to me, led by Christina Puccia, who is a registered foreign agent and was hired as the DeSantis's press secretary several months after she was arrested for violating the restraining order I had against her. So this was an intense 24/7. One of these accounts has tweeted about me or at me 165,000 times in 2 years. Twitter did nothing. I mean, these people were doxing me regularly. They posted documents that didn't just have my home address. They had my driver's license number, which someone used to change my voter registration. They had my height and my weight. Not that I really care. I mean, I'm going to guess at my weight anyways. And my height's about 5'5" and a half. I don't care. But all of that combined identifying information has been used to change official documents. And it caused a real headache for me when I ran for Congress. So when that article finally came out, I started responding to these people who were harassing me and calling me a liar with the link to that article. And after doing that for about 2 days, I got suspended. And it said for spam. I first thought I probably just shared that link too many times. That's not a big deal. Mm-hmm. But somebody who's this big of a user, I'm sure they'll just restore my account. Well, 15 minutes before I was suspended, Christina Puccia tweeted out how glad she was that I was finally suspended. Oh. And the governor's office, who at the same time was filing a law to ban social media companies from suspending political candidates as part of their no censorship on social media thing, celebrated it. And for the entire time I ran for Congress, I was not allowed on Twitter. 18 months. They unsuspended me a month after the campaign ended.
It's just unconscionable. It's unconscionable. And I think that they felt, Rebecca, in the beginning, here you are, this beautiful blonde white female. And I think they thought, we can wipe her out in no time. And
young too. I was only 30 when this all started.
Yes, young. And I'll tell you, you have this internal iron core. I applaud you for that, because you have put up with the slings and arrows of paid people who have put vicious rumors out there.
Oh, yeah. At one point, they started a rumor that I was a pedophile. They've started rumors that people like you, who are my allies, hate me.
I was shocked when I heard that. I was shocked.
Yeah. And a lot of them, there's only really five or six of them that do it, but they have many different accounts that they switch between. One has been served a cease and desist and apparently just wiped their butt with it because they keep doing it. And they'll use many accounts to make it seem like it's a popular opinion. They'll do what is called wedging, which is trying to harass supporters to the point where they don't even want to write about you because they don't want to have to deal with, you know, the people that are going to harass them about it, or to erode support among your biggest allies so that they won't mention you or support you publicly. And, you know, I get all this, I think, unfair credit for being so strong, because that's, you know, that's part of my default mode, is when I'm attacked, I tough up. But that doesn't mean that there haven't been really dark places or times. You know, what my kid has gone through. My younger daughter was only 2 when she was held up at gunpoint for 3 hours. So she seems to have, if she has internalized it, it hasn't manifested yet.
Yes.
My son was 11. And the last 2 years for him have been extremely difficult. And that is a big part of it. I think it was weird because I kind of got tipped off that the raid was coming the night before, and some very cryptic language from a person who never spoke like that. And I actually brought it to my lawyers and said, something is off here. Mm-hmm. Something's going to happen. I told Chris Cuomo that night, I said, I think something's going to happen and the governor's going to come after me. I don't know what for, but I think it's going to happen in the next like few weeks. I didn't think it'd be the next morning. And as soon as I told him what had happened, I said the three words that every journalist, you know, on TV in the world wants to hear, which is, I have video. And I showed it to him and I told him I wanted to go on that night to discuss it. And he said, are you sure you're up for that? He said, yes. I saw the video, the whole like hour plus long video. He's like, I think maybe you should just take a minute. You know, it's okay. We can do it tomorrow. And I was like, no, I need to address this tonight. Yes. And I look back at that interview sometimes now, and I don't know how I had the wherewithal or the strength to do that. But afterwards, I cried for several hours. I questioned mm-hmm. whether or not this fight I was fighting had gone too far, if mm-hmm. I had made a mistake in underestimating who I was dealing with and what I was dealing with, if the acceptable sacrifice that my husband and I had discussed so many times, like them coming up with a bogus reason to arrest me, which is what we thought it would be. Of course, they didn't arrest me that day. They didn't arrest me until after we sued the police for the raid, the day after, actually. But that was, I was not appreciating the toll that even that would take on my family, much less the risk, that physical risk that they were in because of I was taking that risk. That was a really hard night. And it's when we decided to leave the state. And we moved in just a couple of weeks. As soon as we found a place, we were out. I didn't think we'd ever come back unless DeSantis wasn't governor anymore, until I got whistleblower protection. And I think in that moment, I realized I have to go back and fight too. I can't just be one of these people who just leaves everybody else there to fend for themselves. And at first I thought about going back by myself. And I think that would have been too hard on my family at that point in our lives, having just gone through what we did. And I tried to think of how I could do that. I thought about helping Nikki Freed campaign for governor. I thought about helping, you know, with certain congressional races or Senate races, whatever I could do. And a few people from the state party and the national party approached me about running myself. Yes. Which I had shot down for like a year straight. I was like, you guys are insane. If I'm the type of person you come to run for office who has no political experience whatsoever, was not even like that politically active while I was working because of the jobs that I was holding, which were always state government jobs. I also worked for the state of Louisiana before I moved over to Florida. This is insane. I don't know enough about like foreign policy to be a congressperson. I don't know enough about international trade law. And a good friend of mine said, you think Lauren Boebert does? You think Marjorie Taylor Greene does? He says, the difference between you and them is that you know you don't. And you'll ask the people who do. And that's why you should be in Congress.
Excellent.
They wanted me to run in a very competitive district that a Democrat ended up winning that is not so great. But I was like, I don't know that place. I've been there like once ever on an academic conference, which means I probably never left the conference like grounds. It's like, that makes no sense. It's like, if I'm going to run for Congress, this could be in a place that I know and that I love and that, you know, I have connections with, which just so happened to be Matt Gaetz's district.
Yes.
And
First district.
The rural panhandle. people call it the Redneck Riviera, and I don't think that's insulting. I grew up in South Rural Mississippi. There are 18,000 people in my entire county, and it ain't small, you know, so it's, that was not a deal. I was like, I get these people. I was these people. I didn't grow up rich. My parents aren't lawyers. They're a truck driver and, you know, a hotel front desk clerk and live in trailers in Mississippi. So this is the place that I understand more than, you know, Tampa or Miami or Broward. And we did pretty well. I did on average 6 points better than every other Democrat on the ballot. And we did it without any state party help. And, you know, in a race that nobody thought was winnable, in a year that a million Democrats didn't show up to vote that did last time. But it was an experience. I loved doing it. But yeah, I had no access to Twitter. The massive platform I had built was erased. And even though my congressional campaign didn't even exist when they suspended me personally, they wouldn't let us have a campaign account. And people had their personal accounts suspended for tweeting on behalf of my campaign. So all of the fundraising that we did was outside of that. And that we raised, I think, about $1 million. And we raised more money from grassroots fundraising than every other Democratic candidate in the state for Congress, except for Maxwell Frost. And so that's, I mean, I'm talking about every single one, including like Debbie Wasserman Schultz and all the other Democrats who actually won their races. Yes. We raised more from small dollar donors than every single one of those, except for the first Gen Z congressman in history. So, you know, I got to talk to people. I got to hear what their problems were and come up with ways to fix them. And that is why I went into disaster response to begin with. That is how I ended up in my position. And I felt like I could actually make a difference again. And now, like most whistleblowers, I'm unemployable. Yep. And going back to a government job seems impossible.
Is your political career over? I'm just curious.
I'm not. I've been approached like more times than I care to even say about running again next year. I'm not doing that. Okay.
Not never. Okay.
Not this time. Okay. Because it is a lot of work.
Yes.
Most of what I fundraised had to go to legal expenses and money for moving. And I gave a lot of it away to charity, thinking that surely by now this case would be resolved and I'd have a settlement from the state. And that is not the case. We just filed. Mm-hmm. So I'm out of money.
You do have a GoFundMe, though, correct? It is under your name on GoFundMe, and it is open. So people can certainly, and I believe that's for your legal expenses.
Yes, it is. We also are doing PayPal to try to fundraise for that, because GoFundMe is a little different, but GoFundMe takes a much lower percentage from what you raise than PayPal does. So that's obviously the preferred. But yeah, we think that it's going to cost between $30,000 and $35,000 just to sue the state, between court reporter fees, filing fees, you know, all the different things that go into it. I was surprised that it could be that much. Wish I would have hung on to some more money. But I helped a lot of people. And yes, I always said, like, something that poor people do is they like to fantasize about what they would do if they won the lottery, you know, and we did that all the time when I was growing up. And everyone wanted to go here or go there or get this or get that. And I was like, I give it away. And my dad, My dad always said to me, he said, no, you wouldn't. You're going to grow up and you're going to see bills and you're going to use, you know, you're going to keep that money and you're going to give it to your babies and your grandbabies. I also thought I'd never have kids at this point. So I said, no, I'm going to give it all away. Mm-hmm. And I kind of did win a small lottery and I did give it all away, but I should have kept some of it.
But your story isn't over, Rebecca. Your story is not over.
We're just getting started.
You're just getting started. And I want to ask you about your family because I know what it's like to have the family decimated. And, you know, that's where we carry a lot of guilt sometimes. It's not that, you know, our whistleblowing, which can change the world, but it not only impacts us, but our family, which is a really hard scar to bear. And your husband, how is he doing?
Thankfully, I never changed my name when we got married because I'd already published peer-reviewed lit and I didn't want to break that kind of shame. Plus, I think it's a bit antiquated, so I didn't want to do it. So people were looking forever for this man with my husband's name with the last name Jones and never found him. And that gave him an extra level of privacy and that, you know, he enjoyed for a while, of course, until we ran for Congress. And then, you know, we did pictures together and we went to some events together, things like that, but they mostly didn't participate, but he's doing great. And professionally he's been unmarred by this, which is fantastic. Cause he also worked for the state at the time as a biostatistician, working in public health and kept doing so for, let's see, he ended up getting let go in May of 2022, I think. So for 2 years after I was fired, he kept his job. So he's very educated and works in a field where there's high demand. So thankfully, he hasn't had as much trouble as I have.
Good, good. So tell me what you're doing now today. I know it's been a couple of years since we talked to you. You've always been on my mind. Tell me what you're doing today.
So I am trying to find a path forward, I think, for now. I started a podcast with another congressional candidate that ran in a different district called Misinformational, where we kind of break down how propaganda is generated, the tools and means that they use to distribute it, how Americans can fall for it, and reshare it without realizing that it's false, what the motivations are behind that, who's funding it, why they might be doing it. So it's a weekly podcast where we just kind of break down all of, like, here's some of the misinformation stories of the week. Here's where they started. Last week, we looked at the whole Trump saying that he was going to get arraigned, which was a completely fabricated story that he himself made up. All of it goes right back to him. But of course, everybody started talking about it. The news was going on 24/7. They, you know, rumors became mainstream news. It was actually somewhat shocking to see, like, CNN have panels about how the arrest and perp walk would work when there was zero indication that any of that had ever even been discussed. It was very absurd, but it was like a firestorm. It just took over the internet and mainstream news without any justification or evidence or support or truth to it whatsoever.
And he raised a lot of
money. So we look at kind of,
he raised a lot of money.
He did. We'll see what he says. We'll see when the FEC filings come through, which will be in a couple of weeks. But even that we kind of looked at and thought was a little bit suspect. But yeah, I'm sure he did. He raised a good bit of money. He also elevated his name in the news again, which is what he really wanted. And accomplished, you know, this whole sympathy thing where he's already framed any potential future criminal charges against him as being this deep state persecution, even though the only charge they're considering is like a third degree misdemeanor. Yes. And he wouldn't even go to jail. It's like, yeah, that's real deep state coming after you, man. But so we do that every single week. Sometimes we have guests. I've had a couple people who run alternative social media networks like Tribal and Mastodon on my show. And, you know, we work through that for now. You can listen to it for free. If you get a subscription, there's video. And I mean, I've been told I'm very facially expressive.
Yes. Yes, you are. Now, give me the name of that podcast.
It only conveys in video.
Yes. Give me that name of that podcast. I'm going to start listening.
So it's Misinformational, but it's a play on words. It's MISS. And so I am the miss and I am informational, and we're debunking misinformation. We have a website too that goes with it where we regularly post. I've been doing a lot of investigative journalism again.
Excellent.
Broke a couple of stories with some major news outlets about some of my personal favorite people, including Matt Gaetz and Ron DeSantis, but a few others as well. And, you know, trying to hold social media accountable to the extent that is possible. Make sure that the field of journalism is not further harmed by paid operatives within it.
So I really want to know, Rebecca, you know, a lot of whistleblowers, after the trauma they experience, and you certainly have experienced trauma, not too many whistleblowers have law enforcement breaking into their house where their children are with weapons.
Not in America.
Yeah, in America. So usually after such trauma like that, most whistleblowers need time to put the pieces back together. You have never really taken time to put pieces back together because you have been in that wheel that keeps going around and around. You keep finding ways to be relevant. You're out there. What is propelling you? I really would like to know.
Justice.
Justice.
I am fully aware that our legal systems are passionately disinterested in pursuing cases against those who break the law, who are powerful, whether that's rich or they have authority or connections to either or both. It's very unlikely that people like Matt Gaetz or Ron DeSantis will ever see the inside of a jail cell, no matter how much they should, no matter how many crimes they commit. And I know that I'm not the only person who faces these kinds of fears about speaking out. And so I feel like I owe it to them, to other people, to be a place where they can go and tell things that maybe they're not sure they could trust a journalist with, and or they don't know which journalists are trustworthy, which was an issue I had early on. And I'm not bound by those things in the way that other people are. I'm not afraid that if I write a story that exposes something awful that, like, we're currently investigating about DeSantis, that, you know, I'm going to get fired from my journalism job and never write again. I don't have that fear. I'm free from that. And so I am trying to be an advocate for them. I was really good at my job.
I know you were.
And I went into it passionately because I went through Katrina when I was young. Natural disasters seem to follow my family around, at least my mom, because she's had her house struck by lightning like 2 or 3 times. You know, we went through Katrina. Hurricane George not only hit the town I moved to the year we moved there, it did a loop right over it. It literally went up, did a loop, and went that way. It's very strange for a hurricane. And, you know, of course, she lost her house ultimately in 2020. But I went into all of this because I felt like I was the kid from my very impoverished hometown who got out. I always knew that I was different. I was raised different. Even though my mom wasn't educated, you know, she only had her GED. I always knew that I had the capacity, if I wanted to apply myself, to do something bigger. And so I'm constantly trying to explore ways where I can do that. I would love to go back to disaster response. I would absolutely love it. I know how storms work. I know how climate change works. You know, I'm a climate change subject matter expert in 2 different states. But no government's going to give me the keys to their data if they're worried that their data says something other than what they're saying publicly. And it almost always does.
Yes.
So,
And you know, this is one thing whistleblowers face is usually they can never get back into their career that they blew the whistle on, which is very sad because most whistleblowers, you know, are truth tellers. So they reveal the corruption, and that's what you need out there.
As I worked for scholarships and my advanced degrees, considering the odds statistically of someone with my upbringing, you know, the second child of a woman who had 4 kids by the time she was 19, with no education, living in South Mississippi in poverty, one of the worst states for education and one of the worst counties within that state. It's like, I think, like the 13th poorest county in the country. And, you know, having been slept outside on benches and not had a home, I shouldn't be here. And no. I am. And to have all that education and work I was an award-winning scientist before all this happened, mm-hmm. and have that taken and it mean nothing is, I think, a grief that I still haven't gone through, because right. deep down, I really do hope that I can go back to that. I can help plan for hurricanes, you know, and plan for evacuations, you know, model airlifts that we need to get from islands like I used to do, plan the logistics of delivering emergency medicine. That seems like a very high stress job for some people. And maybe that's why I didn't break down under the stress, is because working in disaster response, every moment is like a life or death moment. And if you screw up, somebody might die. And you have to keep pushing. You have to keep doing that because there are lives at stake. And I've known that this whole time. And maybe that's why I'm in disaster, you know, emergency response mode all the time. Mm-hmm. And you don't get breaks when there's a Category 5 hurricane barreling towards the Florida Panhandle, or, you know, when Hurricane Dorian's spinning for 3 days, 25, you know, nautical miles off yes. the coast of Miami, and yep. you could just take a 10-minute nap and it just arrive. You don't really get breaks. I got the flu during that storm too, when we were working that response, and I was in charge, so that was really icky. But I always catch the flu or COVID. COVID twice and the flu twice, just like in the last 2 years. But yeah, I know that it's important, and I think I'm not. And I know that seems like a very strange position. What I'm fighting for is more important than myself as an individual. Mm-hmm. So I just keep doing it.
Well, you know, you bring that same passion to your whistleblowing, and I hope you don't lose that. I hope also other whistleblowers have rallied to you. Have they muddied the waters, these cretins who are throwing rocks at you? Have they muddied the waters so badly that you're not getting the support from other whistleblowers that you should get?
No, every single person in our community has recognized this for exactly what it is. Dan Ellsberg, I'm Good. Sure you might be aware. I think I saw a news article, so I feel like it's okay to discuss it now. Has been diagnosed with a terminal illness,
yes,
and has decided to forego further treatment to just spend time with his family. He's been amazing to me. He could live another 92 years and it not be enough time on this earth. And the fact that he ever put me on his level and that he continues to do it has been one of the most uncomfortable things to hear from someone like him. Like, no, I'm not. And he's like, you got raided. He's like, you got thrown in prison. He said, yeah, mm-hmm. you might too. And I was like, don't say that.
Yeah, no, you're a bona fide whistleblower. There's no two yeah, ways about it.
Tyler Schultz is great. Having somebody who's about my same age, you know, and kind of dealt with the internet kind of response of this has been fantastic. Him and I hit it off really well the first time we met. Sharon Watkins has actually been very kind to me. So have Olivia Troy, and even some people who I don't think I'd normally be in their circles, Republican whistleblowers, have heard or seen things directed towards me and have immediately like called or texted me and been like, look, they did this, you know, stuff to me too. And I know it's bull crap. You know, you just have to keep your head up. And so that's always great.
Good.
I think sometimes I do feel like forgotten, which I guess is imagine what a lot of people go mm-hmm. through. It's like, I did all of this for people, other people, and what do I have to show for it?
Yes.
Which is a very selfish feeling, which is why, like I mentioned, I remind myself that what I'm fighting for is important and it's not about me. But sometimes, yeah, you do wonder, like, I don't know how I'm going to pay my bills in a few months. I worked so hard to climb out of where I grew up, so hard. And it wasn't easy. I had my son the middle of a semester, my junior year of college, and still managed to graduate cum laude from a top 50 university. And, you know, went and got my master's and trying to finish my PhD. And it took a lot of work. And that was all just ripped away from me. And, I know that's selfish, but at the same time, I'm allowed to say, I think, you know, what do I have to show for it? Did I change anything? Did it really, I'm a math person, did it kind of quantify what difference it made in the grand scheme of Florida's COVID, you know, response? The only people that it seems to, the disinformation and smear attacks seem to have had an impact on were members of the quasi-conservative media. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to have such like a explicit impact on people's opinion. It's very implicit as well. It's like, even if somebody knows that it's not true, if they keep seeing it, it colors their image of that individual. Like, I know some people that I know who are scientists who have been out in the public eye contradicting, you know, conservative narrative about just kill all the old people, we'll be fine, the economy is important, who they've accused of being paid by Big Pharma, which is the most popular attack. A lot of these were in the arsenal of the anti-vaxxers to begin with. And I noticed myself even not sharing those people's content as much because I was inviting a whole different league of trolls mm-hmm. in that I didn't want to deal with. I have my own. I have a whole army. I block them. They can still comment on my stuff. Yep. You know, they harass every single person who mentions me or yes. responds to my comments. It's a loophole that Twitter has that they really should deal with. One lady told me the other day that she just shared sympathy on one of my posts, and one of my stalkers found her identity, found her bar number because she was an attorney, threatened to file a complaint with the California bar against her, threatened her job, threatened to sue her just because she agreed that the harassment that I was going through mm-hmm. was unwarranted and that Twitter needed to do it. I mean, these people are psychotic.
Yeah.
They literally Brutal. Wait all day, every day for me to post something so that they can attack people who respond. It's not even about me anymore. It's about eroding response. And like I said, even I found myself doing it. I mean, I don't even talk about crypto because I don't want to deal with the crypto trolls, even though it's a complete scam. And, yes. you know, it just needs to stop. Every time I mention it, I get all the crypto trolls. And I haven't already blocked all them. So I have to go through a whole new phase of blocking, and that's never fun.
Well, Rebecca, I'll tell you, but people have discovered that whistleblowers are unique, and their very basic makeup does not allow them to do anything but, you know, seek justice, blow the whistle. So part of your makeup has led you to where you are today, and I really hope that you join in our campaign for making a National Whistleblower Day permanent.
Absolutely.
And that you are going to be, because we want to put your name out there. We want to embrace you and say, here's a whistleblower who has sacrificed so much. And that's why we want the National Whistleblower Day permanent for whistleblowers, because they have sacrificed so much. And you are an example of that. Yeah.
And hopefully in a few months, there will be a film directed by an Academy Award nominated director, documentarian, and a very close friend of mine. The only famous person I ever knew before all this happened. And
we'll
even Academy Award for documentaries isn't like, you know, famous like John Cena that I now talk to. It's the world is bizarre. But yeah, I mean, I let that crew into intimate moments of my life. Things were unfolding as we were filming. I mean, I literally got that email while we were in Mississippi interviewing with my mom and my sister. It's incredibly intimate and personal. And yeah, I would love to do whatever I can with Whistleblower News about exclusive interviews with the director. I can absolutely arrange that. He's my friend. He'll do it if I tell him to do it.
No, we're looking forward to
and,
that documentary. We're really looking forward to that. And we're looking forward to enfolding you in our campaign, which is, you know, nwd.campaign.org. And
yeah.
We just are delighted that you have come out on top, really. Through the slings and arrows.
It doesn't always feel like that.
I know it doesn't feel like it,
yeah.
But it's true. And when this documentary comes out, you're enfolded in this campaign, people are going to see they didn't get the best of you. The best is still to come.
I hope so.
It is.
About trying to be private a few times, and I tried it once after we were raided. I actually stepped back from doing public interviews for 2 months. And worked on more long-term projects. And that's when the troll army was assigned to me. That's when Christina Pushaw started attacking me. even when I wasn't on Twitter for 18 months, there was an incident in which one of these people published photos of the inside of my house that were taken while I was living there, the layout, the windows, while I was living there with my kids, and published them on Twitter. I wasn't even on the platform, and these things were happening. And you can't even report things on Twitter if you don't have an active account. So I couldn't even report them to get them down. And some of that is terrifying. You know, I got phone call death threats. That's politician stuff, though. I put that in that box. But it was the same trolls that have been harassing me about COVID and DeSantis and my whistleblower case that published photos of where my kids slept, where their beds were, where the windows were. And of course, my home address, which they love to share all the time. And I couldn't do anything about it.
Unconscionable.
It's just, and that is the thing that I think at this point in my life, I am trying to grasp most. That's where most of my energy goes to, and trying to find ways that I can advocate for that to change, because no other platform today will allow those things to do it. Facebook, it got scared after the whole congressional hearings about 2016 and how they were dealing with misinformation and Cambridge Analytica. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when Francis
Hogan,
the Facebook. Yes, Facebook whistleblower came forward and said how they were promoting hateful, angry content because it drove more views and reactions. And they don't let you show pictures of the inside of somebody else's house on Facebook. I could have gotten that taken down, but Twitter does. And so needs to be accountability for that.
I'm just delighted, Rebecca, that you've brought us up to date. And I really look forward to working with you in the next year for our campaign, for your documentary. I'm really excited about that.
I know. It's forever.
I know. And it's important that people see and know what whistleblowers go through. And it's just shocking. And so I'm really glad to have you on today. I think you are just one of the strongest women. And I appreciate what you've done for your country.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca.
You have been listening to Whistleblower of the Week, a program hosted by Whistleblower Network News. Please consider making a donation to support programs like this. Visit whistleblowersblog.org/support for more information. Just as hard.